I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Rory Sutherland's On Brand, brought to you by Alf Insight. In each episode, we talk to the big names of the world of advertising, marketing, and media to dissect and debate success, ingenuity, and the future possibilities for our industry. And today, I'm joined by Pip Murray, who's the founder of the eponymous nut butter brand, Pip the Nut. Pip began producing nut butter in her own kitchen in 2013, before launching her company in 2015. The Pip and Nut range, as you know, soon became the fastest growing brand in the UK and is now stocked in supermarkets and food outlets throughout the country. So Pip, well, first of all, huge kudos and congratulations for spotting something that probably eluded almost everybody else. And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
It's a joy. So you began by selling these jars of nut butter at a weekend food market. This is a common... it's a common story with interesting new artisan foods, I think, that people test them at small scale, or at least I think what we owe actually is that the what you might call the food truck movement, the artisan food truck movement, food festivals and so forth, are actually hugely valuable in being a kind of petri dish for innovation in new foods. Because it's a way at which, at smaller scale, you can test the viability of products. And you started in London. So how did you make the leap from that to effectively standing behind a counter to being stocked in the food hall at Selfridges just 1 year later? Because there must be a load of people who'd kill for that kind of distributional break. How did you manage it?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I think food markets and, you know, any kind of city, but London in particular, has like such a burgeoning food industry that it is a great way to test it, and it was a great way to kind of build the concept as much as anything else. But yeah, I started at Maltby Street Market down in South London, and I was at that particular moment in time still working part-time at my day job, and I was giving it a go on the side. And for me, I didn't work in food and drink, so my background actually was a theatre producer before I started the business. So I didn't have a business bone in my body, didn't know what FMCG stood for, like, you know, real novice. And I felt like it was like the first, like, you know, the first easy kind of step that I could make to kind of actually start a business was to give it a go at a market. So for me, that is almost like the easy bit, where you're testing it in your kitchen and you're making it physically yourself. And I think the biggest step and the hardest step when you're starting something up and looking to scale it to become more of a national brand is that kind of how do I make this product at scale to the quality that I make it in my kitchen. I think that's always the hardest bit for anyone entering this space. So finding a partner, and you can do it two ways, I guess. You can make it yourself and scale it up somehow by buying a production facility or, you know, something of that ilk, or you can work with a partner, manufacturing partner, and I chose the second option, which was finding a partner to work with. And that took about 8-9 months actually. That was probably the hardest bit. Partially because when you're a small startup business, you know, you don't really have any distribution. Nobody really wants to work with you. And it's a funny thing where you kind of a bit of a penny drop moment where you realize nobody responds to your emails because actually, like, you're inexperienced, you don't have any volume. So a lot of factories don't want to take the risk on you. So, you know, you do have to roll out your kind of sales pitch and really kind of go at it when you're kind of trying to kind of convince someone to kind of work with you. And then I guess there's the other side of the coin, which is finding the right people that you trust and believe also can deliver on their word, I guess.
Did your partner have, interestingly, did your partner have food industry experience or?
So I say partner, I guess I mean manufacturing partner. So I'm sort of a sole founder, so I didn't actually have a co-founder in the business, which is, probably another story around, you know, that as a challenge in itself. But yeah, the manufacturing partner that we ended up used in the end to kind of get the brand out the door was, a brilliant factory because they really understood what it was I was trying to achieve and could also work with me on that kind of relatively small scale. So, I think once you've got that bit cemented, you can start to actually think about what is the brand that I want to create and really start to build it out. And that was, I guess, the next big thing was kind of, I guess, the brand that you see today is, you know, what was created back then about sort of 7-8 years ago. And I think that equally is a really challenging bit, is trying to find the right creative agency to bring what it is in your heart and in your mind out into something tangible and real. And I do think the Pip & Up brand, it's like playful logo, it's very distinctive, was one of the big things that has to be done. And I guess once you've got that package of product and brand working, I think that's when you can start talking to retailers like Selfridges and looking for someone. And in actual fact, Selfridges came across the product when I was still selling it at market, and one of the buyers reached out to say, you know what, I love this product, is it something that you'd consider, you know, taking into or consider selling into retail? And that was how it started, really, with Selfridges. So was really lucky in that sense, didn't have to do that cold calling, which, you know, you often have to do, and really worked with Selfridges. Once I'd kind of figured out how I was going to scale it up, I reached back out to them to say, I think I'm ready to kind of launch this brand, and thankfully they took it.
What drew you to the category in the first place?
I mean, I think for me, it's a few things. I think you mentioned it earlier. I guess I've always had food in my veins in terms of my family. I'm part of a big family. I've got three older sisters, and food's been a big part of my upbringing. In actual fact, when I was growing up, my mum gave up cooking when I was about 11 and handed it back over to me and my sisters to cook for the family. And I think that was probably the first sort of thing in my childhood that really sparked my like passion for food. Cooking every day for my family was just something that came naturally after a few years. So for me, it was, I think that was probably the one of the threads. But I think the second piece was really this category. I was a consumer, so I was shopping the category and I was doing lots of marathon running at the time. And so peanut butter is great because it's nutritionally rich in protein. It's kind of good for you in terms of for pre and post running. So for me, it was something I was eating naturally. But when I was picking up the brands in supermarkets, every single brand I picked up had palm oil in it. And I think as someone that's slightly more health conscious, but also kind of more conscious from an environmental perspective, I was like, I just don't understand why this ingredient is in there. And I think the final piece was just the fact that like this was a product I loved. I ate it all the time. There was an opportunity to make it a better product. But also I think the brands in that space were so tired, very worthy, and didn't really like communicate what I really loved about this product, which is like the taste and the flavour and, you know, that addictive quality that I think nut butter, peanut butter has. And I felt like there really was a lack of kind of that lifestyle brand, which I think I could see in other spaces. You know, the obvious one being Innocent was a brand I was inspired by, but there were other ones around the store that I thought really brought that kind of emotive, emotional brand to the forefront. And so I thought, you know what, there's an opportunity in this category to kind of do that, I guess, fill that gap.
And I have to say, what is interesting in the Anglo-Saxon world, because this is true in the United States, maybe even more so. Mm. I'm very pro kind of hipster. OK, I think that hipsters are kind of the shock troops of innovation in the lifestyle economy. And what I think you notice is that the Anglo-Saxon world, particularly the US and UK, had a particularly bad food culture because they industrialized very early. And if you look at the US, I mean, until recently, the US was a disaster area for beer and cheese because the whole thing was centralized, actually, in both cases in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Wisconsin. Mm. But they had this sort of extraordinary kind of economies of scale thing where production became concentrated in one huge place. And, you know, I mean, I can remember being in the US 10 years ago and you could basically get two kinds of cheese. There was the kind of the yellow one and the slightly red one. And the beer, the choice of beers was dismal. Now, actually, I'd probably rather drink beer in the United States than anywhere else on earth, which maybe Belgium, okay, northern France. But I mean, I never thought I'd say that. And what has happened, I think, is that the farmers market culture, things like the Good Food Awards, small local producers, have actually essentially put back, you know, France always had the peasant culture, which was, I mean, France was, very interesting statistic, by the way, I always love this one. In France, 50% of the population was rural, i.e. it didn't live in a large town or city, up until 1950. The US reached that point in 1920, and the UK, actually, fewer than 50% of people were rural by, I think, 1850. Extraordinarily early loss of a sort of rural population. And so this kind of hipsterism has actually brought back what early industrialization took out. And I think, you know, I mean, now, you know, to be absolutely honest, I mean, I'm going to scandalize a couple of my French colleagues, but I'd probably rather eat in the UK than eat in France, which was an unimaginable thing to say, you know, when I was a kid. And that actually access to high quality food and variety. The French do have some really weird foibles. Like, do you really need a yogurt aisle that's 200 yards long and full of identical pots of white yogurt? I have no clue what they're doing there. It makes no sense to me at all. But this is something which I think Britain is doing disproportionately well. I think it's incredibly exciting. We're also, in fairness to Brits, we'll try anything.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we don't have that native food obsession, you know, we're I think fairly syncretic with food, in that we'll kind of adopt ideas from anywhere else without considering them somehow polluting our kind of heritage or whatever, which also, I suppose, means that our lack of an indigenous food culture has become a little bit of an advantage in adopting other people's. Mm. But I have to say, what you're doing is absolutely magical. And one of the things, I suppose, that you was very timely is that nut butter is pretty high in protein and pretty low in carbs. Is that fair?
That's fair, yeah.
So a change in the belief system around what's healthy food can't have done any harm. And there aren't very many protein-rich, carb-light, long-life convenience foods.
No. And likewise, I think there, when it comes to kind of healthier options, like healthy food, if you like, particularly in this sort of space, I think there aren't that many that are actually genuinely tasty and delicious. And I think that is really difficult to land at the same time. But I do think your point around the shifting perception of what is sort of healthy and good for you, like things like good fats, as an example, like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, margarine was what everyone ate. And that was the norm. And that was because it was, you know, less fatty than, you know, other like real butter. And I think there has also been a big shift in like people accepting that actually calories aren't all bad. And also fats can also be good. And that actually, it's what you put in your food as opposed to what you take out. And I think there has been a slow progression around particularly diet culture and things like that, which has changed also perception of products like ours. So I think, yeah, those kind of movements in food has definitely helped. We've definitely been on the tailcoats of that kind of growth and trend as well.
It's interesting. I just noticed that sales of nut butter in the UK have overtaken sales of jam. Mm-hmm. Which again would have seemed inconceivable only a few years ago. And that again, I suppose, shows the shifting perception of sugar and carbohydrates versus protein and fat-based foods.
Exactly, yeah.
I have a friend who's a doctor who told me that the great misunderstanding about this was that dietary advice tended to be compiled by cardiologists, because cardiologists had noticed that a buildup of fat essentially, you know, it was bad news for heart health. But the cardiologists all assumed that dietary fat created bodily fat. And of course, if you'd spoken to people who were endocrinologists or who understood metabolism and digestion better, they'd say, whoa, 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 hold on a second. Quite a lot of bodily fat actually comes from the body's processing of sugar into fat.
Yeah.
And so there was a widespread misunderstanding, which almost came from the accidental fact in English that the word fat both means a food type and a thing that you have on your body. And the assumption was that one led directly to the other and there was nothing else going on. So I think you'll be the big beneficiary, I think, of new dietary science, which I think is really fascinating. So how do you make, you've made pip and nut really stand out. How have you kept it distinctive, do you think? Packaging, obviously. Anything else?
I think for me, like it, I think the identity of the brand has been, well, it's been a real like joy, I guess, over the last 7 years, is how that sort of the brand has evolved and the world around it has evolved. But I think the tone of voice around it, as much as anything else, I mean, we if anyone knows our logo, you'll know it's got like a leaping squirrel and it's got a tail that kind of forms the P of the pip and nut. And it's, I think, really distinctive and, like I said earlier, playful kind of identity that you can have a lot of fun with. But more than that, you've got a kind of a character and a kind of personality that exudes that you can build on. So simple things, and, you know, this is just one example, but for instance, some of the words that we use in the business. So our office is not called the office, it's called the nest. We don't look for things, we forage. You know, we don't just eat stuff, we scoff. So there's a bit of squirrel energy and that we try and embody throughout our business and brand, and that not just is in the brand itself, but it's in the kind of the people and how we hire as well. And I think the more you can create that kind of moat, I guess, around the business and the kind of identity, really is where it all starts and stops, and, you know, you can really build off the back of that, has really helped. And I think, you know, we've started now in like more recent years doing sort of above the line advertising, which was a big deal for a small brand like ours. Like it, you know, the first time seeing it on a tube underground station, these big posters, I think the advertising itself has been a lot easier to land and has been much more sticky, thanks to the fact that we've got a really distinctive brand identity. So, for instance, one of our biggest first campaigns we did was we basically shot real life squirrels in Norway, and we used different sort of shots of these squirrels and found expressions and quotes from our Instagram where people kind of were saying, oh my God, I love this product or something like that. And we quoted it and we used a squirrel that kind of embodied that kind of feeling within the quote from our fans. So effectively the fans were our squirrels, which is really fun campaign and really kind of grabbed people's attention, because on the underground station there were these giant squirrels that basically took over. So I think there's just little things that we can have a lot of fun.
By the way, this is the thing that the ad industry will never tell you because it sounds so banal.
Yes.
Okay. But using animals in advertising basically makes your advertising more effective. My argument is that we've evolved to look at animals. Okay. We've had a million years where we pay more attention to living things, in particular animals, because we can eat them, they can eat us in various cases. And so the advertising industry never says, we'll try and use an animal in our branding. Dulux dog, Andrex puppy. Okay. The entire oeuvre, basically, of CDP, sorry, of BMP, you know, if you look at that, was, you know, basically creating the Hofmeister bear, creating the dog for John Smith's Tonto. Okay. Now, no one can stand up in front of a board of directors and say, what animal can we use? Because it makes you sound ridiculous. It's nonetheless, I think, true, basically. That, and actually, someone from Adam and Eve said the same thing to me.
They said,
look, basically, when we can, we get some sort of anthropomorphic or other animal into the advertising because it just makes it more effective. I worked in direct marketing, and there was a mailer for BT for their spring sale, which one year was about three times as effective as it had been in any previous year. And they went around everybody asking why on earth this was. They couldn't see that there was anything different about the offers they'd made, anything about the rational propositions. And everybody was sort of post-rationalizing with things like the economy and, you know, economic optimism. And they brought it to me and I said, no one else is going to tell you this, but you've got a load of rabbits on the envelope. I would be absolutely confident that if you took the rabbits off, you'd find this thing was a third as effective. So you've whether by accident or design, you've happened on one of the great truths in advertising that no one will share because it makes you sound kind of dumb.
Love that. Space for, we're in the UK, we're suckers for fluffy animals, basically.
I mean, we generally like, I mean, people do call them rats with tails. I think that's very, very unfair. But, you know, but generally squirrels are fairly well liked.
That's it. Well, it was quite funny conversations actually in our office, because we spent quite a long time sort of defining how fluffy the tails should be on the squirrels, because to your point, if they're not fluffy enough, they don't look cute enough. So yeah, I think some people in our team thought we were absolutely mad when you find yourself having these sort of like long-winded conversations about how squirrel-like they should be. So yeah, it was good fun. But I guess, yeah, we have a lot of fun, I think, with the brand. And I think because of the fact, the identity in itself allows you to kind of play around with it. And I think also second to that is whilst I talked quite a bit about the functional benefits of the product, as a business, actually, rather than sort of selling those functional benefits, we try and sell the taste and flavour, because actually I believe that, you know, it's better to try and sell, you know, convince people to try and try your product from a taste perspective, and then tell them behind the scenes, oh yeah, by the way, it's also quite good for you. Kind of, it's much more of an accessible approach to food. And so, yeah, I think we're not preachy, we're not patronizing, and we certainly don't kind of drill down on that functional piece, because I think it's quite boring, really, and also I think a bit inaccessible, I think, for some people.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, you benefit from the naturalistic fallacy, which I think in this case is appropriate, which is, it's highly unlikely that nuts are an unhealthy food, and very likely they're healthy, simply because we've kind of evolved to eat them. Certainly in northern climates, it probably was. Because if you think about it, one of the problems with dietary health is that high carb foods tend to be both cheap and also long life. Okay. Now, you've got something which is unusual, which is it's high in protein and, you know, and low in carbs, and yet it's actually a long life and convenient food, whereas most high protein foods are actually a bit of a faff to prepare and they go off in 3 days. So the advertising works, does it? I imagine it does, because it's got animals in it. I can't say that, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one. I guess when you're a smaller brand and you're trying to, gain awareness, it's quite difficult. So it has been the one thing that's really turned the dial on our performance as a brand. So I think the hard thing when you're sort of, and I feel like I'm telling the absolute expert with you here, but I guess, it doesn't always go directly into immediate rate of sales, so you don't expect these huge peaks in performance in your rate of sale, but it does do a massive job in driving that awareness, which we'd never really been able to do when we were kind of, whilst we've got quite a big social following as an example, which we've often lent on, or we've used PR, this was a real kind of turning point when we started to invest. And I guess your first advertising campaign will always be the best one, right? And then it's going to be always hard to follow, but yeah, we're learning a lot, and I think it's always difficult because, your budgets are much, much smaller than anyone, your competitors, but also just generally. And so you really got to try and to learn what works for you. But you have to, it does feel kind of sometimes quite uncomfortable when you're suddenly investing in quite big chunks of media. So I've started to get used to it. But yeah, it's a bit of a suck it and see, and see what works for the brand itself.
It's a glorious story, and the fact that there is this pathway where you can go from farmer's market stall or market stall to large-scale distribution. Do most of the multiples stock you now?
Yes, so we're now listed in all the supermarkets in the UK, still in Selfridges as well, so we've still managed to straddle the two, kind of, being in Asda as much as also being in Selfridges, which is quite challenging. But yeah, we've got quite broad distribution in the UK now, which is amazing, really. And sometimes a bit of a pinch me moment when I see our products in all these stores. And it's a really amazing feeling.
Well, I think you've got that great story. Now the category is outselling jam.
Yes.
That actually shelf space needs to be repurposed a little bit.
Exactly.
I'm now going to be on the hit list of jam manufacturers.
I know, they're going to be after you.
They're going to be after me. You don't want to mess with those jam manufacturers, I can tell you.
I bet.
Oh, it'd be absolutely. Those Tiptree boys will be...
They'll be knocking on your door.
Nothing touches the marmalade mafia, of course. I mean, you can't mess with them. But nonetheless, I mean, the supermarkets aren't blind to the fact that this is actually, to be honest, quite a high margin category. Is that fair? For them,
I don't know if it's necessarily high margin, but it's I guess it's all right.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, actually higher margin than jam, almost certainly. Actually, interestingly, yeah. I mean, it's any exports? Are you dabbling with exporting to other countries?
So at the moment, we're very much like focused on the UK and Ireland, but we're looking potentially further afield and sort of scoping that out at the moment. And I think for us, it's always that kind of balance of trying to figure out, not try and do too much at once, but if we're looking at new categories in the UK and where can we kind of broaden the brand, sort of build on, I guess, our success in the sort of spreads aisle, and where can we leapfrog to next. So more recently we launched like a range of nut butter cups, which is kind of like a healthy Reese's, if you like, Reese's peanut butter cups. And so, yeah, we're kind of looking at potentially new categories. So I guess doing that and then also potentially looking abroad. So we're just trying to kind of strike that right balance. But certainly I think there's opportunity in some of the bigger markets and, you know, potentially looking at even the US if that's an option for us as a business. Which feels...
Yeah, Whole Foods must be quite appealing because it's exactly. So you'd be the cheapest thing on the shelf.
Yes.
Anyway, Whole Paycheck, as they call it.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's very, the US food market I find very, very strange because it's completely bifurcated. Mm. It basically seems to split. They don't have a kind of sane middle ground.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around like Sainsbury's.
No.
It's essentially, it seems to be completely bipolar, going from the money no object to everything's bought on price.
Yeah. You know?
And it's interesting that Tesco kind of failed there with, what was it called? Fresh and Easy, I think it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tesco failed because it's such a baffling, weird category.
Yeah.
I suppose you get Trader Joe's, which is a sort of reasonably sane kind of retailer.
Yeah.
But I find American food retail, you know, strangely weird. I mean, most things in the US are cheap, but I remember I was staying with my brother-in-law in Los Angeles, and we went and did a family shop for the two families. It practically got into four figures.
Oh my God.
What the hell is going on here? You know, this is madness.
I know. But, and that's the thing with that. In actual fact, the US is the number one cheapest market to buy food in the world, but actually second to it is the UK. So we do have an incredibly kind of cheap kind of, you know, our supermarkets do a good job of providing really reasonable value for people. But yeah, it is amazing. Whole Foods, I mean, the US have this like real disparate, you've got Walmart on one end and then you've obviously got, yeah, the premium Whole Foods and places like that, which, you know, we're, I guess, quite lucky in the UK that we have a little bit more of that balance in yeah. our offering.
Yeah, I think it helps, doesn't it? Undoubtedly, because you can migrate. I think it's much easier going from Selfridges to Asda than it is going the other way around.
Oh yeah, you couldn't do it the other way around. Yeah,
you couldn't
sure.
really do it the other way around. Turning up in Selfridges and saying this is very popular in Asda probably
it's not going to cut it.
No, it's not going to cut it.
No. And that's the thing, I think with when you're building your kind of range and distribution, it's always quite interesting. I think certainly in the early years, we used to use our distribution very much as marketing. So where we were seen and you know, we focused quite heavily on London initially when we were kind of building out the brand in all the kind of premium places that you'd expect to see it. So whether it's a really cool hip gym to like a really great deli, like it's actually brilliant when you can actually kind of use distribution slowly to actually build the brand and that you can use all those case studies that you build to sell to the Nicardo and then you build from Nicardo, then you jump into yeah. kind of Sainsbury's and then you build into Tesco. And it's like always these kind of steps that you kind of do, I guess, as your brand building. And it's, I think, often not really thought about enough when you're, I think it is to some degree, but when you're building a brand, it's not just about the packaging and the advertising and the way you market it. It's also just where you're seen and how you're seen plays such a big influence on, I guess, the success of a business. So, you know, you never want to, I'm a personal believer of like start small and build from like the premium accounts, because you can never go backwards and never rush too quickly into kind of the big retailers, because you need to do that brand building initially. You need to get that story cemented. And, you know, once you're in Asda, like you said, there's no going backwards. So you've got to kind of do it in a kind of really kind of structured way that's not kind of too fast.
It's very, it is, actually, I think Ocado, I mentioned hipsters earlier. I think online food delivery in the UK, I think, leads the world in that by quite some measure.
Mm.
Not only Ocado, obviously, I mean, all of the major chains do it. And that has some interesting attributes. One, you can probably discover things more easily there, or there might be a little more serendipity. Obviously, if you're an obscure category, it's easier to search. To be honest, I wouldn't know where in a physical supermarket the nut butter was actually stocked.
Mm, exactly. Yeah.
Where is it? It's next to jams.
It's next to jams. Yeah, you can find it in the spreads.
Yeah, those bastards. but it is interesting that actually having what you might call a varied ecosystem of choosing is good news for smaller players, because. And also, the other great thing about shopping online, which nobody ever mentions, they always talk about the convenience of delivery, but there's also the convenience of being able to find things you've bought before. So if you buy something and like it, the danger is in the real world that you'll always forget what it was. And having a record of your past purchases and having those past purchases kind of nudged to you as you near the checkout, I think is, in evolutionary terms, it's very good, because if you're reminded of it, you go, God, I had that and I really, really liked it. I'd better buy it again, you know. Whereas actually, you know, that tends not to happen so well in physical supermarkets.
Yeah, and I think if you've got a great product as well, so online, obviously, a lot of people shop by reviews as well. So if you've got great reviews, and partially because you have a great product, or only because you have a great product, then that also really supports you. So I think it's ultimately like, yeah, you put your money where your mouth is in terms of, if you've got a great product, you can rely on the fact that you'll probably do really well online, because people will give you that feedback, and then people will shop by their reviews or by their reviews, and they'll give you a go, and then you get in their favourites basket. So it's a bit of a self-perpetuating cycle.
Yeah, which is, I think is it's much better at what you might call variation, selection, and then reproduction than physical shopping is. So I think the UK possibly benefits from having that, having online purchase. It could be click and collect, arguably, as well, which is just a more reliable way of repeat purchasing things you've liked than previously existed.
Mm.
So I think it's kind of handy.
It
is good news for the food sector, and very good news for smaller players, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly also the likes of Amazon, although, you know, they are taking over the world, but Amazon likewise is a great way of getting that national reach and be able to kind of service like the whole of the UK without necessarily having to sell through, retailers. And, you know, I'm a big believer in sort of, you know, I do still believe there's a place and a need for physical retail stores. I don't think everyone will go online, but it is amazing to see that landscape shifting, and even our own direct consumer as well in the last 12 months or 2 years rather has absolutely exploded. So it is really interesting seeing like this kind of real shift in the retail environment, and as a brand it's great because you can get, you know, particularly if you're a small business just starting out, suddenly you've got access to, like I said, national distribution without having to sell to maybe Tesco as an example.
And if the retailers are smart, what they should do, and they could have used loyalty card data to do this, and I'm never quite sure whether they do or they don't. But there are two things which are interesting, is that if you have a product that isn't bought in huge volumes, but the same people buy it repeatedly, the retailer needs to realise, one, that product availability might be decisive in them using your store, or might be a reason for them to shop elsewhere if you discontinue it. But also, having lateral information, which products are not necessarily very big, but once experienced, never forgotten, as it were.
Yeah.
Once driven, forever smitten. When you have those products with high repeat purchase, they are actually more valuable than products which are bought, you know, very occasionally by a huge range of people and only once.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know how well, I'm very annoyed that Collier's cheddar cheese seems to have disappeared from a large number of retailers, because it was a kind of game changer for me. I'm Welsh, so I have a natural affinity I don't think dairy products should, you know, be really quite right if they come from east of the Welsh border. But you know, I treat them with suspicion. But I mean, it does interest me that both loyalty card data and also obviously online shopping should improve that understanding, which is that 10 people buying something once ain't the same as one person buying something 10 times. Mm. And I'd be fairly confident in saying your repeat purchase rate is pretty damn good.
Yeah, and we have a really high percentage of loyal shoppers as well. Like on, say, our online retailer, Ricardo, 66% of people buy us and only us, which is actually really, really hard to achieve, because obviously we're all creatures of buying things on promotion and buying things when everything's on deal. And so that is really hard to kind of pull people back to your brand to always only buy your brand, especially if other people are promoting at the same time. So
yeah, tip there would be use promotion on Ocado, but use it in a, don't make it price promotion. In other words, make it a multi-buy or buy this, get this for less.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there are lots of ways on Ocado you can do promotion which doesn't devalue, it fundamentally doesn't deposition or devalue the basic product while still providing people with a nudge to try something.
Exactly. And I think it's a true test of a good brand if you're not having to deep discount. And, we don't discount on or we do some promotions, but we'll never do half prices or we'll never do buy one, get one free. Those sorts of things which just... people aren't buying necessarily your brand then, they're just buying something because it's cheap. So yeah,
you might want to do a buy two, get one free on the grounds that people who are large households who are consuming a huge amount, the price margin obviously is they're much more sensitive to that than smaller households who are consuming less.
Mm.
So there's not a, I mean, if you like, it's like the season ticket, okay? If you can't charge the same price for someone making a journey 200 times a year as you can for people making the journey once. So there is a way in which you can practice price discrimination through multi-buys. I'll give you an example of this. I always think the hotel industry is absolutely stupid in not discounting a second room for your kids.
Mm.
Because if you think about it, a couple with no kids, okay, is staying in one room and they're paying for it with two incomes. Whereas a family of five is paying for three rooms, quite possibly out of one income.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's more expensive to stay in the Premier Inn, okay, if you've got three kids per salary, than it is to stay in a five-star hotel if you're a dual-income couple without any kids.
Yeah.
And so there are cases where I can see why promotions, you know, in the same way that you sell large quantities for less in the States, in the US that goes slightly absurd.
Yeah.
You know, washing powder containers that kind of, you know, basically supply you roughly until the next millennium.
To the end of time. Yeah, exactly.
That's partly because Americans have basements. Someone explained that to me.
They've got space.
Part of the reason for that. They've got the space, you see, and you can basically be a bit of a hoarder. Whereas in the UK, you wouldn't actually be able to get into your bedroom.
Yeah, especially if you're in London. Yeah.
How was your COVID experience? Sales presumably held up pretty well.
Yeah.
It's not a bad product to stockpile, actually.
Yeah, yeah. If you're going to sit on anything, it's probably a good thing. It was a very busy year and a half, actually. So when when COVID started to hit, I mean, it just sales went through the roof, because I guess we sell through grocery channels, we sell online as well, and we're a product that people eat at home, so more people are eating breakfast at home. I think there was like something like 10 million more eating occasions at home every week thanks to COVID. Obviously people staying at home more often, so we benefited off the back of the fact that people's shifting behaviours meant that they were at home more often. And I guess with nut butter, it is, well, something most people eat it at breakfast. You do also snack on it throughout the day. It's kind of a good thing to have on, I don't know, an apple, or, you know, you could have it, you know, as a snack on an oat cake or something like that. So yeah, it was crazy actually. And I think the tough thing in that environment was just trying to keep up with the demand when everything else is also moving and you're working with factories that, you know, having staffing issues and not being able to get supply in from different things. But it's been definitely probably the last 2 years. I mean, we were lucky in the sense that sales were massively up, but an incredibly difficult couple of years for working in food and drink. And obviously right now we've got all the driver shortages and inflation in the market happening because of pricing going up. And yeah, it's just really difficult. It's a really difficult time. But yeah, I think we were lucky in the sense that during the last year and a half, I guess lots of people probably tried our brand that maybe might not have done before. And so that was, well, that was great. And yeah, from a team perspective, I guess the biggest challenge is that you've got a very young team. I've got quite a young team, and you know, we all live in London, living in small flats, and you're actually just trying to keep that cohesion, which I think when you're a startup, so much of what you rely on is that sort of real camaraderie, that togetherness that you get in the office. And we have an office in Spitalfields. It's a great area. We go out a lot there, and it's brilliant.
That is a great area, isn't it? Fantastic.
It's so great. Yeah. And just suddenly going to being remote, it, like, some of the energy got lost out of the business, I think, in terms of that feeling of togetherness. And so I think that was probably the biggest challenge as, like, I guess a leader within the company, is just how to keep people feeling like you're all working together and together in that sense.
There is a counter argument to this, which I make occasionally, which is, whereas you may not want your own staff to work remotely, it's hugely to your benefit if your consumers can.
Yes.
Because it's a huge increase in disposable discretionary income. And it also means more people spend more time at home, which means that Pret's loss is your gain.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm always asking that Henry Ford question. Henry Ford sort of created the two-day weekend in the United States because he realized if it became established, it was then worth people buying a car.
Is that right?
And he thought, Henry
so
Ford actually
fascinating.
Thought, he actually believed that leisure was essential, a reasonable degree of leisure was essential to the growth of a consumer economy. It was an extraordinary insight.
Yeah.
And I think so. And by the way, there's also a little counterbalance, which is if you go into the office 3 days a week, one of the things I find is that people in the office now are there because they want to be there.
Yeah.
So they're much more friendly and sociable and generally open to conversation and engagement than they were when, you know, 40% of people were there kind of under duress.
Yeah.
And they really wanted to just get on with writing something in silence, but they were forced to sit among a load of people having a chat.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, making the working week a bit more bifurcated, you know, 2 days where you get on with stuff, and you can concentrate, and 3 days which are more dedicated to sociability, may be actually better than trying to solve for the average.
Yeah.
But it's certainly good news if your consumers can do it, because, as I said, it's a huge amount of sudden, you know, it's like a big tax cut for, okay, now, a lot of people can't work remotely, we shouldn't forget this, but quite a lot of knowledge workers and quite a lot of other people, actually, carers and so forth, can now find employment which doesn't require them to commute. I also think that's true of retired people. I think most people retire because they want to stop commuting, not because they want to stop work.
Yeah.
So actually this, and also I think it'll promote a foodie culture. You know, we've worked a little with Gusto.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the prognosis for those food kits is actually pretty good. Because, you know, when you get home, when you effectively stop work at 6:30 rather than getting home at 8, your appetite for rustling up something interesting is going to be that little bit higher.
A lot more scratch cooking happening. Absolutely. Yeah. It definitely is and was a little bit bittersweet every time lockdowns happen, not only because obviously it was a global pandemic and not great, but also, working at home again. But like you said, sales would increase every time lockdowns happen for us. But yeah, I definitely think that balance of 2-3 days, whatever it ends up being, we're back in the office 3 days a week now. And people, certainly it's a much more sociable environment. And yeah, I think generally, we're starting to get that feeling back, I think, that we had before COVID, which is, that togetherness, like I mentioned. But yeah, I think the working world has shifted in a really great way. And I think for women in particular, and being able to kind of have a bit more balance and be able, you know, with looking after children and things like that and family life, it definitely creates much more balance, I think, within the workplace. So I think it is a good thing that these things have shifted, for sure.
Do you draw on your theatre experience still, unconsciously or consciously? Do you think it's influenced the way you've taken the business and the way you manage staff and teams?
Yeah, I mean, so I think a little bit, but I studied anthropology at university. So
okay, there's no better thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. By the way, Gillian Tett's book Anthrovision is very good because she's an anthropologist who found herself in the business world.
Mm.
And so anything Gillian Tett writes is pretty interesting from an anthropological perspective.
I'll definitely pick that up.
So that's hugely valuable. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a funny one,
A bit of Bourdieu never does you any harm.
Exactly. No. Gosh, yeah, no. That's throwing me back to my university days. But yeah, so I think I did a lot of work on material culture at university. That was like what my dissertation was on, actually. So I think weirdly that has definitely fed into certainly how I understand sort of how objects are perceived and how people interact with things around them and what things mean to them in their homes as well, as much as anything else. So I think that's probably the thread that's probably linking through my career, which, you know, I worked in the arts and I was always quite passionate about museums and things like that, which was why I stepped into the creative world. And that was the Leapfrog, and the Science Museum was where I worked as a theatre producer. So it's slightly weirdly connected. It's funny, isn't it, when you look back at your career and you kind of think, oh, if I speak on a face value, it sounds very random that I started a nut butter, peanut butter brand. But in lots of ways, you can see how all the threads link together, and certainly anthropology has been an influence on me for sure. And I'm a people person, and I love observing how people act. And I think I love, more than anything, watching people in supermarkets. It's so satisfying when you can see people's choices being made out, and what they're doing is so, so interesting.
I'd rather hire people whose parents ran a shop than hire people with an MBA. Because I think, well, you know, you notice if people grow up in a sort of small business environment, I noticed it about my daughter, you know, when she did restaurant work, that restaurant work or working in a shop teaches you about business fundamentally in a way that you'll never actually learn academically at all.
Absolutely.
You know, it creates that kind of instinctive understanding, which I think can't be taught in a classroom. It's a kind of tacit form of knowledge.
Yeah, and I think people intellectualize business a little bit too much sometimes. I think there's something really, like, as much as I can, I try and get out into store and just try and be near shoppers and consumers, because that is where you learn so much, and that gut feeling that you often respond to as a business owner, entrepreneur, whatever, is often because of that knowing feeling of understanding your shopper, understanding the people that you're serving. So I think it's so powerful, and you know, you can have all the data at your fingertips that you like, and don't get me wrong, data is useful in lots of ways, but like really you need to be close to who you're trying to reach so that you can understand them and speak to them as much as you possibly can. So yeah, I did hundreds and hundreds of samplings in Whole Foods and Selfridges in the early days when we were starting. And I tell you, a lot of the product development came from just watching and observing and speaking to people as they were trying our products. So, so powerful. And I guess in the anthropological world, that would be sort of ethnographic research. You're observing people in the wild, what they're doing. So yeah, it's an incredibly powerful thing, I think.
Have you got any line extensions coming up that you'd like to plug?
We have. I mean, we've got a few things coming out the door. Our latest one, actually, we've just created the first ever Pippinut Advent calendar, which is only live, actually. It's only a small run that we're doing through our D2C and through sort of Whole Foods and some of our iconic stores. But it's a really fun product. It contains our nut butter cups, which are like a chocolate product. So if anyone wants to have that, it's vegan. It's very nice. It'll be landing literally today or tomorrow. So you've got a little bit of an exclusive there.
I forgot to mention veganism as one of the other happy things that's probably contributed.
Absolutely. Yeah. The growth in sort of, and that kind of flexi kind of life as well, like people wanting to kind of flex in between the two. Yeah. Veganism. It's funny. It's gone from, I guess, being something that was probably a bit like boring and like not particularly exciting to now being like the hot thing in food and drink. And it's not just, I guess it's kind of slightly being rebranded now to plant-based, hasn't it? So it's this plant-based lifestyle that people are looking to leave, which I think is, I mean, we're a B Corp brand, and we as a business think a lot about kind of people, planet and profit, and at the moment really thinking about sustainability. And really, like, if you're going to shift one thing as a consumer, stop eating so much meat, think about other kind of forms of protein that you can get. So we're lucky that we kind of fall into that camp naturally.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. What nuts do you use in total? Peanut obviously is one, is it?
Yeah, we use peanuts.
Which technically isn't a nut.
You're right. It's a legume.
Yep, sorry.
You know your nut. Very good. Most people don't know that. So we get our peanuts from Argentina. And our almonds are from California. And then we've done a couple of little things around cashews or hazelnut, but the main ones are peanut and almonds, because almonds and peanuts are the most popular in the UK anyway.
Ah, got it. Excellent. Yeah. And you're not thinking of going into things like, you know, milk alternatives, anything like that? You'll stick pretty much where you are for now.
Yeah, we're going to stick where we are for now, but we do have kind of... you know, our sites in kind of like the snacking world more broadly. So we're thinking how we can potentially broaden out into there. But We actually did have a range of almond milks, which we launched a few years ago, but they weren't successful, actually. So we ended up pulling them. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why they just didn't work, I mean, it's an incredibly crowded space. But also, I think people looked for our brand for like real, like permissible indulgence and taste and flavour. And we launched them and they just sat a little bit flat. And I guess I spoke a little bit about we're not really a functional brand. And as soon as we went into that space, it was like, they just didn't get people shouting about it. And it was just funny. And that was one of those ones where you kind of, I was doing samplings in store and people would try that product and they would be like, yeah, they're okay. But when people eat our nut butters, they're like, oh my God, this is so delicious. And it was just that reaction that I just thought was really interesting that, again.
And of course, the cups are clever because it's got a bit of portability then.
Exactly, yeah. You can eat it on the go and they're super tasty. Bit of a treat, but still kind of feel good about eating it because it's less sugar, etc., etc. Yeah. So yeah, they're great, and I think you've got some flying your way over the next couple of days, so you can have those later on the weekend.
Oh, sensational! Thank you very much indeed. This has been an absolute joy, I have to say, and I've suddenly realised we've hit time. So tragically, although I could have gone on for another 20 minutes, that's all for this episode of On Brand. This podcast is brought to you by Alf Insight. And for more information on powering your business growth, you can just visit their website at alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. The series is produced and beautifully edited by Ultimate Sound and Vision. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And to help our algorithmic potential, if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then please give us a like as well. So all that remains for me to say is see you next time, and thanks for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.